are back. My name's Atif.
I'm Robert.
I'm Scott.
All right, so Robert, you have been out, and you've been out at, like...
I was comatose for 2 full weeks.
Yes, that's right. You were hit in the head softball. No, you've been on a kind of vacation, a little sabbatical.
Yeah, it was absolutely a vacation.
Yeah.
Took some long books out into a cabin on a lake in the Canadian, I guess they call them cottages there, which sounds very silly to me. But there's a whole cottage life culture in the summer.
Do they have grass roofs?
No, it's not a thatch hut. Okay. But we were a little early for the season. There's a, you know, the right time to go. And I didn't really quite realize that the weather wasn't as nice as it is later in the summer. But the real problem is the black flies. Do you have experience with black flies?
No.
They are foul, unfriendly creatures. They swarm around your head, and little tiny creatures, when they bite you, it swells up pretty good.
Oh, wow.
So that was the only, I guess, fly in my ointment. But it was nice. It was a good vacation. I needed it.
And you were pretty much no phones, no outside information.
I'd like to say that, although, in fact, we got a hotspot, a Wi-Fi hotspot, so we could watch the Warriors games, because my friend is also a Warriors fan, both from the Bay Area. And that also meant that we had enough data, if we wanted to see right. What ridiculous stuff. I tried not to, you know, do what I do here, which is check the news every 2 or 3 minutes.
Right.
But yeah, I wasn't completely isolated from what went on, although I would like you guys to catch me up because I'm sure I missed important details.
But I'm curious, when you were there, did you check any headlines or were you able to totally stay off grid?
I did check headlines. Yeah, I checked headlines. I tried not to look at everything, but I scanned to see what new thing was on Twitter.
What did you read?
So I read the third volume of Karl Ove Knausgård's My Struggle, which for some reason he named that deliberately.
Just like the mustache. You never name anything My Struggle.
I mean, he could. I don't know why. I'm actually still, like, it's a great book, but I don't know why he went with the Mein Kampf reference.
Yeah.
I started Stefan Zweig's The World of Yesterday, about the life before World War I and World War II in Europe. And I also read Ta-Nehisi Coates' Between the World and Me, which is fantastic.
Oh, yeah. He's a good writer.
Highly recommend that. And I read The Medieval Origins of the Modern State, which was also very good. Short little book. Catch up my comparative politics.
What are the medieval origins of the modern state?
It's just talking about what the incentives were for European monarchs to move from a feudal system to actually have administrative departments that governed the state, essentially built up the administrative state.
Was it a combination of threat of being killed plus money?
Well, it was to gain power, essentially. And they
better organize and fund an army?
Yeah, better organize an army. But actually, the army came later. That was one of his points, is that they didn't really have the resources for standing armies at that point.
Right.
What they needed to do really was things like tax collection, and also circuit courts were a big way they expanded their power. They figured the king could extend his influence that way and get people. But it also drew people into the state, drew regular citizens to the state with juries, which helped extend his power, but also later provided checks on his power because you have popular involvement in the state. So the administrative state that Steve Bannon hates so much.
Right. The deep state.
State is deep, man.
It's super deep.
So what did you do while I was gone?
We are caught in the maelstrom, the news maelstrom. It's just a torrent. It's a constant torrent of news. And we've tried to live our lives, but yeah, there's been.
How's that going?
I'll tell you, it's oriented around the news. And so actually, what were the, having gotten back and sort of re-immersed yourself, how do you respond? Are you just like, this is more of the same? Or do you feel like, wow, this has gotten even crazier? Or is it even crazier, but you also feel like it's more the same because the same is everything's getting even crazier?
The widening gyre. I don't think it's even crazier, though it does feel like a progression of crazy. I don't know exactly where it's heading, but one of the things that happened, I guess, while I was gone was that James Comey testified, and I was a little surprised by this, but that was apparently watched by as many people as game 4 of the NBA finals.
Yeah, like 19 million people, I think.
But why did so many people watch the basketball? That's what I don't understand.
That's right.
To take their mind off the Comey testimony.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I thought it was a great finals. There was very high level basketball.
We didn't speak about the Comey hearings, and
not a high level political hearing.
No, but I was still surprised how much he actually said, because there's a giant difference between him being interviewed as a former FBI director as opposed to a current one. And I thought, it's not smart to get rid of guys like this.
No, and he's clearly a very capable bureaucratic operator. Yes. Jeff Sessions seems like he's in over his head.
Yeah.
I agree with that. So did you watch the Comey hearings live?
Yeah. No, I didn't. That I avoided.
You were running from black flies.
I did.
What did you think of the hearings? I worked from home that day, and we had it on the background. I know a lot of people who had it on the background and were monitoring it through the day. Like, it was just a thing everyone seemed to be glued to. But yeah, what was your perception of it?
Well, I was basically surprised at how much, basically, I was going to say how much detail he went into, because when he was being questioned before, when he was still director, it's like, you know, they're always referring to, well, we'll go into closed session. And I thought it was interesting that the areas that he was very clear about what he knew, and the areas where he said, I was surprised he got into things like facial detail, like where he's saying, Sessions, well, I can't really say, you know, he was sort of a shrug, or I'm not sure. And he wanted to be clear that he wasn't saying that definitively. And in the past, I thought he was trying to stick to facts. You know, these are the exact words said, this is the exact thing, not these were the emotions that I felt. And so that was a change. And that actually seemed like he was, you know, for people who would be against Comey, to say, oh, you know, that's getting a little bit political. That's not just hard details. But I also thought it was interesting that Sessions actually essentially did not refute him. So the only thing Sessions refuted him on in his testimony was when he said, I'm trying to think how this exactly went. Oh, when he came in to tell me that he felt uncomfortable talking with President Trump alone, you know, it's like, well, he didn't say lectured him, but, you know, more or less I lectured him on, you know, what should be done, what are the rules. And I felt like Sessions was saying what he knew he should have said, not what he did say.
It's an interesting point, because I sort of have that intuition as well, but that's the kind of thing that our general bias could fill in. Like, he said, she said kind of thing, and I have opinions about Sessions and Comey.
Right, and I could say, obviously, once again, my bias comes into this, because I think that in general, I was not really pro Comey in terms of what he did during the elections multiple times. But at the same time, the only thing I've ever seen him get caught up on in a sort of a technical lie, I shouldn't say a lie because a lie shows intent, but during the hearing earlier in the year, he made some comment. I'm trying to think what it was. It was about, I think it's about the number of emails that appeared on the server or whatever it was.
He affirmed it was hundreds of thousands when it wasn't, or something like that. Tens of thousands.
So, yeah, right. So he made a mistake. But with exception of that, he's not known for saying a lot of lies. And I would say that that basically Sessions appeared to be very, very loose with the truth on his hearing, his confirmation, his Senate confirmation hearings. And so my current view of Sessions is not only that, with his line of questioning this last time, was that he is not exactly being forthcoming. And so if it was Trump against Comey, I'm biased to say that I would consider Comey a more credible witness. But even with Sessions and Comey, I do think that he's not, just because I agree with where he's going, but I think that his background is more credible than Sessions. His history of being accurate.
I have a question. Did anyone have, what's his name, Charles Ray in the FBI director pool?
No.
To stop just for a second, I'm hearing like either a highway or a toilet or something like that.
It started to torrential rain.
We're back, because I want to hear the story now.
We're back.
Yeah.
We took a little pause because there was some raining.
It was literally raining so hard in Hawaii we could pick it up on the microphone.
The tropical storm. It rains very heavily here.
But then we started talking about pig gods. Yeah. Sure. And barbecue. And now, so you're talking about the pig god. Aren't there, I feel like I remember a few, kinds of these supernatural stories / ghost stories in Hawaii involving local gods? So tell me the pig god story. Who believes in the pig god?
All right. I don't know how many people really believe in it now. Well, it's a story, except people do get a little spooked. They don't want to bring pork across the Pali. The Pali is this sort of cliff pass you go over. And the rumor is that if you bring pork across it, your car will stall. And old woman with a dog will come out of the woods. I think I'm getting this right.
The old woman with the dog is a recurring story I've heard in Hawaii.
It may be. I think she represents Pele.
That's correct.
I think she represents Pele, and you give the pork to the dog or something. But it has to do, she had a bad relationship with the pig god who lives on the other side of the island, and now you are not supposed to cross it. And I think I did it once. I did it. We had some pizza with Kahlua pork on it, and we were a little spooked because we heard people say, oh, this happened to us. My car stalled. No one's seen the woman. It's one of those things that, like, I have no belief in this, and yet it's still creepy when it's, like, the middle of the night and it's raining.
Yeah.
I don't know that Hawaii has any more, you know, superstitions than any other place.
I feel like I live in the land of superstitions, so I can't even start to talk about this.
I thought Dracula was real.
Give us a remaining superstition before we get back on track.
No, I want to get back on track, actually, because we have too much to cover.
But the big stories today, CMEC U.S. politics, one is the shooting. A shooter from nearby Belleville, Illinois, who apparently moved to D.C.
Yeah.
There was a practice. Republicans and Democrats have a softball league, and the Republicans are practicing.
They described it as baseball. Is it softball? I thought it was softball, but I saw baseball.
Almost always softball.
But do they use the big balls? Is it just rhetorical?
I have done C internships and done the softball stuff. I've never seen baseball. I've always seen softball. But maybe it's baseball. So there's the shooter story, and then there's the Washington Post report that Mueller is looking into Trump for obstruction of justice. But I want to talk about the shooter first, because last year, we did a podcast, because I think it was just before the election. I was pitching a black swan, one of which was violence. We were asking whether or not we might see sustained violence. And I thought about it in the context of, will we see something like militia action or a group of people who are so incensed that there will be a kind of sustained violence, like sort of militia style violence.
You were not thinking about 66-year-old white voters that were in favor of Bernie Sanders?
No, I did not have that in mind. I did and do think that we're in an environment where violence is more likely. And part of that is inflammatory language on the left as well. I think a lot comes from the right.
All sides.
So I think it's a lot of partisanship, too.
On both sides.
Each side is demonizing the other.
I think it stems from two things. I think part of it is the inflammatory language. And I think part of it is the fact that a lot of people have expressed not feeling like they are in control. Like there are forces on the right, it tends to be elites, or the deep state on the left, it tends to be the rich and this kind of industry capture, government capture, and that they don't have recourse, that their government isn't receptive to them, and so they need to resort to something else to be heard. And that was one of the explanations that was given for Trump being elected, and that's also one of the explanations for the violence. And in fact, there were reports after the shooting that some Congress people on the left and the right, or Democrats and Republicans, were getting calls from people and emails saying, I think there was a report that some Democrats essentially got calls saying, you guys are next. And there were also reports that some Republicans were contacted and said, what did you expect when you are doing these policies? You're not listening to us.
Horrible. It's horrible. It's horrible that people are doing this. I mean, it's not surprising, I guess, that people are doing it, but it's still appalling when you actually hear about it.
Yeah. Right. So, okay, I want to get to the not surprising, though. So we have seen more than I can recall, I'd say at least recently, more of that kind of violence, more of the, are you a Democrat, are you a Republican? There was a story in the South of some student who went to a coffee shop with a machete, asking people if they were Democrats or Republicans because he wanted to attack Democrats. Of course, there was a Portland stabbing, which was motivated by, it was a white nationalist who was talking to and berating two women, one of whom was Muslim, one of whom was African-American, I think. But he also said something about liberals. I think before he stabbed those men in the neck, he said something just sort of attacking liberals in general.
Yeah.
So I guess my question is, do you see more of this on the horizon? Do you think there may be an escalation? Do you think it's about the same? Do you think it will calm down? What do you think in terms of this very partisan violence?
I think it's going to continue. I don't know if it'll escalate, but it might. I think the fundamental factors that cause it are going to continue. And I think part of it is really this increasing partisanship. And it's not wrong to think that Republicans aren't responsive to their Democratic constituents and the Democrats aren't responsive to the Republican constituents. I think in general, parties are not as responsive as they used to be to constituents from the other side. And it allows them to demonize one another. And I think we're going to continue to see this kind of attacks, so people do feel powerless. It's totally crazy, but
I also think that both the Republican and the Democratic sides have major schisms in them. So it's easy to look right now at the Republican side and say, you know, divided into Trump voters, Trump supporters who will support him regardless, you know, versus the rest of the Republicans, or also Trump supporters, like when they're trying to get the healthcare bill passed, you know, those who basically are diehard on certain economic issues and won't allow certain things to go. But on the left also, it's like, okay, it seems right now like the Republican side is kind of falling apart. But on the left, you also have those who are saying we should go really in the full direction of Bernie Sanders versus more moderates and, or, you know, middle of the road people. And obviously this guy who was a shooter was a Bernie Sanders supporter. And obviously he's not a typical Bernie Sanders supporter, but there was certainly a feeling during the elections that they, that if you were, you know, that if you agreed with Bernie Sanders or were more on the more to the left, that you didn't have voice and that the system was against you, that the Democratic system was against you, the Democratic Party was. And so I see on both sides, there's a real possibility for further splits.
I tend to think the media overplays or plays up the factional disputes among parties. There always are these kinds of disagreements about how the Democrats should, what strategies should have and how far to the left they should be. And the same on the other side.
I'm not thinking about the media. I'm thinking about the split in my own brain.
You're
schizophrenia may be worsening. I don't know about that.
That could be. I think so.
No, but I do think that to some extent they're real divisions, and politics is about really important stuff. I mean, tens, hundreds of thousands of lives are at stake in some of these decisions. So it's not crazy that people are really passionate about it and, you know, think in this really shallow way about trying to affect politics with violence. But I think that there's not a lot of confidence in norms, confidence in the other side will treat you humanely. So I think that makes the situation a lot worse.
I agree with that. Two of the stories within the last week or week and a half, one of which is the secrecy with which the Republican version of Obamacare, the repeal and replace, in the Senate is done in complete secrecy. So it's easy to see why you would say you guys don't have, like, you are not our representatives. You are actively withholding material information from us in a way that's very unusual. Then there was a story that the Hill reported, which was the Republican Senate wanted a rule. They couldn't be interviewed on camera without permission from a couple of people. So they wanted to really control
in the hallways. They don't want to be interviewed in the hallways, and they already won't, you know, they're not going to town hall meetings. Where can they be interviewed anymore?
No, exactly.
Grocery stores?
Exactly.
I mean, seriously, I don't know where.
Away from that, after there was an uproar. But it seems very clear that there is a desire to reduce scrutiny, to not expose themselves to scrutiny, because a lot of it ends up being beratement.
I think it's called bunker mentality.
Yeah, no, I think that's right.
Right. Well, so it has to do with what they're passing. I mean, I think they know the content of this bill isn't good in the normal sense.
Trump said, actually, that the first bill, the bill that was passed by the House, now he called
mean,
it mean.
Mean, he called it.
Yeah. He's throwing them under the bus.
It is. And that, he asked them,
exactly.
He asked them as a favor to him to vote for it, and now he is telling them they're mean to do it.
Exactly. It's like, oh, people
right,
are like,
fantastic.
You guys are terrible for doing this.
Leadership.
But that approach to governing, we're not going to attend town halls, we're going to keep the media from having an opportunity to interview us, we're going to draft a bill that affects 1/6 of the economy in absolute secrecy. We're not even going to tell our own members what the content is. We voted on the previous bill before a lot of people had a chance to read it, before there was a CBO score. I can see why people would say, we don't have, like, there is no recourse. These guys are not answerable to us. They are shutting themselves off.
It's not democratic.
No, it is absolutely not.
We're still staying totally on the Republican side. We're staying completely on the Republican side on the, I mean, dealing with Republican issues. And the guy who was shooting today, I mean, obviously that's an outlier, but he was a left guy. So that doesn't fit the norm.
No, what Atifa's saying is that people like him might feel powerless because Republicans are.
Sure, I understand. I understand.
It goes both ways. Both sides are doing it.
Right. Sure. And so that to me suggests that we may see more of this. We may see more of this kind of political violence because people know that there's a material piece of legislation that's being drafted. And there are others as well. Like there are material things that are being done in Congress, and Congress is taking extraordinary steps to not be answerable. And that to me is troubling. Like if you don't offer people an opportunity to engage, and you know, I it's funny. I did mediation as in law school, my senior year of law school. I trained as a mediator and did mediations in New York. And one of the things the guy who trained us said was venom. People need to get their venom out. Like let people talk a little bit and don't just say, "Hey, here's a structure for a solution that I think meets all of your needs." There's this kind of emotional component, what I'm feeling, I need to be heard. That was cited as a reason that people supported Trump. And that to me seems like something that could also lead to an escalation of this kind of violence. So to me, it's as a kind of forecast of like a little forecast of violence, I would expect if we see more of this, what you called accurately, Scott, a bunker mentality, see more of that, I think it is increasingly likely that we will see more of this violence, especially if Trump's response, you know, I mean, Trump said almost nothing to the shooting in Kansas City where the Indian students were, or I guess they were engineers, were shot by someone who just thought they were Middle Eastern and asked for the papers.
Right.
The stabbing in Portland, Trump was silent on. He said something about this attack on the Republicans. If it's only one-sided, or if he is sort of mute about this kind of violence in combination with how Congress is behaving, I think it could get worse.
I also think that there's going to be, as investigation continues on Trump, depending on how it goes, if it's really taking him down, then I could see his supporters feeling like their vote is being usurped. At the same time, if he stays in power and there's a lot of information out against him and the people around him, and you see that nothing changes anyway, you know, no matter what investigations, that will also make the people on the left say, you know, this is stacked. It doesn't matter what he can do. There's several lawsuits against him now on emoluments, but not only that, there's, you know, his whole, I shouldn't say his whole administration, but many people in his administration have issues. And if none of that, you know, turns out into anybody losing their jobs, I think that'd be pretty frustrating on the left to have this feeling that there are no rules, there are no more checks and balances or controls on the executive branch. And even, I mean, I don't think that most people who are prone to violence probably aren't watching the Sessions testimony, but when you hear somebody consistently say, I can't talk about this, you get a feeling that nothing can be done, essentially, short of whether Mueller does a good job and then whether the Congress moves on it. Either way, this could go badly.
I bet this guy did watch the Sessions testimony. I think he's exactly the kind of guy who did.
That guy probably did. That's why I sort of back off on that statement.
I think we need some kind of bipartisan deal on some level that we will respect norms and enforce norms, and that I really honestly at this point I think means Trump has to go, but then the Democrats will not try to take political advantage at some point, allow Republicans to retain, because if it that doesn't happen, I think that this that continues to pull us apart.
Yeah, do you know, I agree. I think the essence of the bipartisan deal isn't some kind of we're going to respect norms, because I don't think that can last internally. The most encouraging, you know, people talk about green shoots, I think the most encouraging things that I have seen in terms of restoring a respect for political norms have been on the right and its criticism of right-wing media. And the two people I can think of, the one person I can think of, I guess Mike Murphy, but also Charlie Sykes, has written a few op-eds, and I've seen him do commentary in a couple of different sources. And he was a Never Trump conservative. He had a radio show in Wisconsin for a long time. And he has written recently and somewhat extensively about how right-wing media has really distorted the right. It made it very, very hard for people to engage in anything productive, because it's essentially just these auto-da-fé purity purges. Like, are you a rhino or are you a real conservative? And, you know, there's sort of this constant progression towards greater and greater right-wing purity. And so I think you need to have people pushing back against that. And Charlie Sykes is doing it. I think it's interesting. It will be interesting to see if there's any story that Fox is dropping the fair and balanced tagline from the channel. And it'll be interesting to see how far that rebranding goes. But if it ends up being a real attempt to get past the, I don't know if they're going to drop Sean Hannity, but get past that Hannity-like or that Rush Limbaugh-like, anything short of capitulation is a loss. Capitulation by the other side is a loss. I think it's, to me, what is going to be a real signal that we're turning towards that isn't any kind of internal pledge by Congress. It's whether they feel like they can distance themselves from right-wing media. And I haven't seen that yet. In fact, we've seen the opposite. We've seen Trump bring Breitbart into the White House. We've seen Trump bring InfoWars into the White House.
I think right-wing media is terrible for, if you're a normal Republican, loves your country, it's not good for your party in the long run. It's not good for anything in the long run. You always, Atif, talk about the line from A Man from All Seasons. I think it's when all the trees are cut down, what will protect you? And I think there's an element of that. Sooner or later, the right-wing media comes for everyone. It just circulates around. It reminds me more of like the Cultural Revolution. No one is safe in the long run from being, you know, accused of a lack of purity or being a rhino.
That's what, I mean, Boehner made that point.
Yeah, Boehner, I mean, here's a diehard long-term Republican, and, you know, he became the victim ultimately.
Yeah, he lost control of the caucus, lost control of the Freedom Caucus, if he ever had control of it.
And no one could have controlled it. Paul Ryan is on a thin thread, you know, hanging by a thin thread.
Yeah, Google Paul Ryan and rhino. It's unbelievable.
Right. Right, and he was the one accusing the people of being rhinos before, right?
Yes, yep.
Actually, I don't know if Ryan, he used the rhino tag, but...
They continue to push towards some phantom version of purity that just rolls over every Republican who attempts to do any kind of compromise. And they're driven, I think, right-wing media. And until they're willing to denounce that and willing to say, no, we think compromise is okay. We think an incremental approach to achieving our goals is okay. We think acknowledging that the Affordable Care Act has its roots in the Heritage Foundation, okay, like it is okay that an idea that a lot of conservatives formerly endorsed that has now been co-opted by Democrats, it's a victory for us. It's not like we need to now go further right, because if Democrats like it, it must be bad.
Well, they can change their mind too. No, they might honestly change their mind, but don't pretend that it's some exercise in tyranny when it was your idea.
Yeah, that's right. And that's it. Oh, okay, actually, this ties in. This is the second thing I wanted to talk about. One of the Charlie Sykes is, I found really interesting, I think it was a few weeks ago, essentially this piece where he said he thinks the way to understand the right now is they are just anti-liberal. They're anti-Democrat. So anything that's liberal, anything that's Democrat, they're opposed to. And a way to understand Trump is Trump gets support from his supporters when he trolls liberals. When he makes liberals mad, makes Democrats mad, that's when his supporters love him the most, because they're not pro any particular policy. They're anti-liberals and anti-Democrats. And so one way to understand the Trump administration is that he is sort of their chief troll. He is someone who attacks liberals, attacks Democrats, makes them mad, irritates them. And when he does that, he gets support. And it's interesting, but it made me think, and we were talking about this before a little bit, part of the podcast, about models for understanding the Trump administration. I want to get your thoughts on this. And I'll run through a few that I have read. And I would like to know if you guys have any others, if you think we can combine some.
Before we get into models, there's one area that I was thinking about. And that's, if we were truly two separate parties and each of those parties were unified, then what Trump is doing, you could say, would make some sense. But it's like, if he gets his base by trolling, and that's,
it's fair enough,
let's say slightly more than half of the Republican Party. I'm just making up numbers out of my head. But if it's slightly more than half of the party, then that means that still he's getting around, let's say, 25%, 30% of the country with that, which is not enough to really effectively govern. And in some countries where they have parliamentary systems or where they have really multi-party systems, he would probably be the leader of one faction. And so if you're looking at something like France with Marine Le Pen or Farage in UK, whatever, all these different places, he would be one minor party who right now may be trying to form a coalition with a major party. And somehow it functions differently. But when you only have two parties, it has a very different dynamic.
I wanted to cite a there was an interesting piece in The Atlantic a while ago, which I think was after Trump pulled out of the Paris Agreement. And it basically described Republicans as the rolling coal party. You guys know what rolling coal is, right?
I know coal. I don't know rolling coal.
Do you want to explain this, Atif?
Yeah. So rolling coal is a thing you do when you want to show how much contempt you have for liberals and their regular eating latte sipping.
Oh,
ways.
Yeah.
Where you outfit your truck. To burn coal. To burn coal black. You set up plumes of black smoke to show.
And there's no functional purpose for this. It is just a middle finger to the people that would like to have clean.
Exactly.
It is. And I think that's the only explanation for the climate change, or there's no real clear policy rationale for pulling out of the Paris Agreement. It's mostly a middle finger. This is something the other side wants. I mean, that's my interpretation of it.
And what happens if you drive a Prius to a rolling coal event?
You probably get beat up.
It's like right wing. It's peacocking. Yeah. It's right wing peacocking. I roll my coal. I hate climate change. The Paris Agreement is stupid. Yeah. As many people have pointed out, when Trump announced he was pulling out of the Paris Agreement, it's all upside. Unless the simple act of staying in the Paris Agreement is something you can be attacked on. But in terms of the agreement itself, it's just, you're just signaling we care about climate change. A lot of the rules are unenforceable. A lot of the stuff he cited in the speech in terms of costs and jobs, all that stuff is nonsensical. Well, among other things, clean energy is a growing industry. It's a great source of jobs. I think it's eclipsed coal and a lot of other more dirty sources of energy. It's all upside. Unless you promise people that you will get out of these kinds of agreements, and so you want to maintain that promise. And I agree with you. I think rolling coal is right.
I don't think it's just maintaining a promise. I think there is a trolling element in it. I think it is a dark triad. Trump is like 4chan created a politician.
One of the reports was when he shook hands with Macron and Macron kind of held his hand until he white knuckled, Trump was embarrassed. And Trump was a report that one of the motivations for getting out of the Paris Agreement was essentially to thumb his nose at Macron, who wanted to stand. Way of saying, screw you and your agreement.
I wish that were totally implausible, because that's the stupidest motivation I've ever heard.
Unfortunately, it's plausible.
But
yes.
I don't know. It's plausible. Okay,
back into Trump models. So I'm going to run down the list, and then we can discuss them, which ones you find. And I think there's some overlap in these. These are the ones I've seen when people are sort of discussing Trump administration and trying to put together a model for motivations and predicting what it's going to do. One is, I think David Brooks has talked about this. A lot of other people have too. MSNBC, you see this a lot. He's an infantilist, which is basically he has a mind of a child. Or he's sort of the emotional development of a child. Can't sit still. Doesn't have an accurate sense of who he is. He has difficulty perceiving how other people are thinking. And as David Brooks puts it, have a theory of the mind. And there are a lot of people, subscribe to the idea that he's it. He's this sort of child. He's just not a mature individual. And that ties, there's another sort of theory. There's a piece in the Washington Post by someone who wrote a book on bullying who said, Trump is like a bully. Trump, and in fact, people's response to Trump in the sort of situation of uncertainty is how kids respond to a bully. Like if they go to a new school, they'll gravitate to the bully at first, because the bully sort of offers this security when they're feeling insecure. And then, and the bully will, it's like sort of a safe place for them to congregate. And then they gradually drift away from the bully as they mature. One is Trump as a populist. And there's a journal that started this year called American Affairs, which was started to be a kind of policy counterpoint to Trumpism. And it was a sort of recognition that Trump has these ideas that he's sort of vaguely articulated. There's no real policy heft behind them. We can be a journal that pushes this policy forward. And they, and it's interesting, it's AmericanAffairsJournal.org. And they have tried to give some weight to a lot of the stuff Trump said on the campaign trail. Some stuff he said contradicted other stuff he said. But a lot of stuff they talk about, which is correcting trade imbalances, universal health care, investing in infrastructure. They talk about using the Canadian model for immigration, which focuses on highly skilled workers, echoes stuff Trump said on the campaign trail, even though it's not necessarily stuff he's using to govern. There's one theory, there's a political piece, which is to understand Trump, he's literally just not Obama. Anything Obama did, he just wants to do the opposite of. Trump is evil. There's a Slate piece, which just said he's evil. That's, if you want to go there, you can go there. There's a, Trump is a nationalist globalist. Apparently he said that in an interview. Not quite sure what that means, but there's this idea of nationalism reflecting the way he approaches sort of multilateral agreements and his approach to the world in general, which is just the America first, articulating America first. There's a transactional view of Trump focused only on winning and losing, either personally or whether we as a nation are winning or losing or beating other countries. And then there's the Steve Bannon, this is a Steve Bannon quote. He said, in an interview with The Times, Mr. Bannon said, everything Trump is doing, all of it, is to get ahead of or stop any potential crisis. And so this theory is, Steve Bannon believes in this worldview where history is cyclical, approaching the fourth turning, which is crisis, an era of destruction, there may be war, and everything they're doing is to prepare for that. And the famous Steve Bannon whiteboard, where he says a list of all the things that Trump promised, and he's checking them off, may be the easiest way to understand what Trump is going to do next. And then, of course, there's the Trump is just working for them. And who knows? Who knows if that's the case? But out of those sort of, and then, you know, obviously there's some overlap between them. But out of those different approaches to understand what Trump is going to do next, which one do you guys find the most interesting, the most compelling? Or do you have any others?
Well, I don't want to be a hedgehog. I think that generally simply explanations are too simple. But Trump doesn't seem to me like he's exactly some kind of a cipher. Like maybe he has hidden depths, like he may have loved the sled he played with as a child. But I don't think you have to go into the deep end of the pool to analyze his behavior. My interpretation, I guess, is that basically...
Infantilist bully?
Well, I think that most of those frames, I'm going to say that Steve Bannon is the one that's totally projected onto Trump. But most of those frames are basically right. But I think they all stem from the fact that Trump is just an epic world historical narcissist. And these are all symptoms, ways that narcissists behave. They're grandiose. They demand loyalty from others. They have little empathy for others or ability to see others as anything except objects relative to themselves.
Are you talking about the cabinet meeting?
I mean, that's extraordinary, right?
I was just going
to
say that.
They need others to be down, to be debased and humiliated so that they can be psychodynamically up. He believes the world is zero sum because that's sort of the seesaw mentality. You know, for the people to be down, for me to be up, they have to be down. And he doesn't have a lot of strong ideological commitments besides I'm great and everything I do is wonderful. And if bad things happen, it's because I'm being persecuted. And I think that he has maybe a few impulses. You could say he's a little bit populist because he wants to be loved by the people. That's part of his narcissism. So he tries to appeal to people, but I don't believe that he has a cyclical theory of history or these kinds of things. I just think he has these personality traits that make him a bully. I don't know if he's evil. That's a theological question, but you could certainly say some of the things he does are evil. So I think that a lot of these things stem from this just tremendous, really extreme narcissism. That's my view.
No, I fully agree with that. And I think that I'd say a sociopathic narcissist, because you could still be narcissistic and probably have some, you know, some care for those around you.
But if you're really extreme, you don't even really grasp that other people fully exist on the same level.
So here's my follow-up question. If the approach is the best way to understand Trump and the Trump administration is he is a narcissist, he's maybe a sociopathic narcissist. And so it's all personality driven. His personality drives his policy decisions. How is that predictive? Like, where's the predictive power that it gives you? So, for example, Trump, the Trump administration vis-a-vis Iran, if you're looking at what the Trump administration is going to do in terms of their Iran policy, how does Trump as a narcissist inform that?
I think it's really difficult because he doesn't have strong ideological or policy commitments, I think, except to maybe liking authoritarians and maybe hating NATO. But like personality wise, he seems very predictable. He's going to be, you know, he's erratic in some ways, but you know, he's going to do the same pattern of behavior. He has not shown a lot of ability to change, but it's hard to know exactly how that's going to work out. Will he end up attacking Iran? It's almost like flip a coin, whether or not that happens to suit his narrative at that time. So I think policy-wise, it's very hard to predict.
I would give a couple examples that during his campaign, he spoke a lot against China. He spoke, you know, constantly against China. And also, I would think that Saudi Arabia would not have been viewed as the best friend of a Trump administration, but Saudi Arabia put on a nice, you know, nice party for him.
Those are his people, too. I mean, those are, he relates to King Salman.
Sure. Sure. But he also somehow managed to get along with the Chinese leader. And I don't see how internal politics in Iran. So I think China could basically play real politic and be like, OK, in some areas, we'll give Trump some glory, you know, treat him as a fellow world leader. Fine. I don't see how Iran can do that very easily because they have their own factions in their country in terms of, you know, more conservative theological versus more moderate. And I don't see how, I mean, and I know the moderates won recently, but still it's, I think their grip on power is somewhat tenuous. And so for them to just be like, okay, we realize that Trump is a narcissist, so we're going to send people over to America and basically, you know, try to pander to that publicly while we privately get whatever we want. I don't think that they can do that very easily, you know, where I think some other countries can.
So, yeah. No, so if the personality driving is the most important factor, A, that would suggest it's going to be hard to predict what he's going to do because it's going to be very personal. It's going to be sort of who has his ear, how is he feeling, who has flattered him the most, who makes him feel as if he is important.
I give an example of something that happened last week, which was the president of Romania met with Trump, and that was there was a, I think, Rose Garden press conference there. And basically, the president of Romania was able to more or less agree with Trump on some policies where they do have agreement. So on NATO spending, you know, on defense, he dwelled on that. He dwelt on the areas where we have agreement and didn't spend a lot of time on the disagreement areas. He briefly mentioned the EU and the value of the EU, which is not really a pro-Trump thing. But there was something where he could genuinely say, you know, look, great guy. He's giving leadership. I think he probably went a little heavy. The president of Romania probably went a little bit heavy on saying, you know, thank you for all your leadership in whether it's counterterrorism. It was actually interesting. He also said, thanks for your leadership on anti-corruption, which is kind of ironic, but that's actually the State Department is pretty good on pushing anti-corruption here. But he gave a very positive message, but I don't see how Iran can do that. If Iran could somehow say, okay, this is just, we know we're going to say these things to get what we want, fine. But their country's politics don't allow it. So in a way, it's like, is the world going to be divided into those countries that can more or less appease Trump to his face, probably keep doing whatever they want.
Right.
But
the lick spittles and the not lick
spittles. Yeah, exactly. I think that may have some bearing. I mean, I think if somehow Iran could reverse their public view towards Trump, they may be able to become, probably not co-equals with Saudi Arabia, but they would move their position forward. But I don't think they can do that.
Hard for me to see him really getting along with the Ayatollah.
No, but I think Obama had some ability to. You know, that's so even though Iran still was not really loving America, I think they could say at least, OK, Obama showed some respect to Iran. Iran showed some respect to Obama. They were able to get a deal done. And it wasn't only about respect. I mean, it's also about they had their economic interests. There's the interest not to make another war. But they both had at that time, the personalities allowed it to happen. And I think there's space for
an agreement between the U.S. and Iran on some issues, but not probably with Trump. But while we're talking about the Middle East, can you explain to me what happened with Qatar? Did Trump get played in some kind of Gulf country? So Cold War. What happened?
Yes. So we have, I've read anywhere between 9,000 to 11,000 troops in Qatar. It's like a major ally in that region. And all of a sudden he just said, yeah, they're
you know, they're supporting terrorism, which they very well may be, but I think you could say that about a lot of different countries there.
Correct me if this is wrong. My impression was that he essentially got his information from the leaders of Saudi Arabia, Saudis, maybe Egypt, Saudis. I don't know. But he has professional foreign policy intelligence people that would have told him a different, more nuanced view, but he didn't. He just trusted the Saudis, I guess. And I know he relates to them, but they're not his friend.
No, and I don't think he gets that. And there's also there's been a long running dispute with Qatar between the Gulf states. And part of this also is that they do Al Jazeera is their, you know, they sponsor that station, which I found to be a relatively moderate station, but they're sometimes critical of other Gulf states.
I didn't know that. Sorry, Al Jazeera is based out of Qatar.
It's financed by Qatar. And I consider them good sometimes, they have
a few areas where they're biased, but they're good.
They're good. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. They're good. Yeah, so part of the dispute is that they back Al Jazeera and also that they may be backing ISIS. Okay, those are two totally different things. I'm against people backing ISIS.
Well, it's a lot about the Muslim Brotherhood too, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And the Muslim Brotherhood is not in any simple sense a terrorist organization, although they might like to portray it that way.
That's complicated.
It's complicated. That's like the thing. It's nuance, and he doesn't do nuance.
A lot of groups there, including Hezbollah, including Hamas, or I should say Hamas anyway, maybe not Hezbollah. You know, it's like they may be working both doing social functions in society and having a very militant wing. You know, it's almost like, I don't know, Sinn Féin and the IRA or something.
They perform some of the functions of a state.
Exactly. So it is complicated. But basically to just say we're going to choose to say that Qatar is, you know, Qatar's bad and another country is good while we actually happen to have our strongest military relations in the Gulf with them is a bit bizarre. Like you think you'd have thought that one through, but obviously he didn't.
But I think that's a thing we can predict more or less about Trump is that he will not carefully think through policies and stick to them. That seems to be a pattern that I don't see changing.
And the result of this is that Qatar is now going to Iran. Iran has been sending food shipments to them. They've basically been cut off from the rest of the Gulf states. And so Iran was shipping, I think one day they sent five plane loads of food. So this is raising, you know, of all things, this is actually raising the power of Iran in the region. So I think it's actually counter to whatever Saudi Arabia is actually trying to do.
I don't know if Saudi Arabia has thought through the implications of all these things.
No, that's what I'm saying. I think it's bad policy on the U.S. and Saudis perspective, from their perspective.
It sounds like you guys think there's not really,
it's not strategic.
It's not a framework. This isn't we're preventing the fourth turning.
He doesn't think strategically.
I'm a populist or whatever. These people make me feel the best, make me feel the most powerful. And this is consistent. Like a lot of the reporting is Trump responds to flattery. As we have seen this in previous weeks. There's a new emoluments lawsuit involving 200 Democrats from the Congress. There have been Maryland. I forget the other state.
It's the one that's supported by Maryland and
there are multiple
Virginia, Delaware. Lawsuits, I don't know,
but in all of them, sort of take the same tack, which is this is an administration that seems to be viable, where he has created this business structure. I think there was a report recently that said a lot of the Trump real estate purchases recently have come from the shell corporations, the owners of which are unclear, and they may be overpaying. They may be vastly over for property. So this may be another vehicle for corruption because we don't really know his finances. We don't know if people are overpaying for Trump assets to curry favor with Trump. We don't know if the reason.
But we do know. We do know because we're not.
Well, his dad apparently gave him a loan for a failing casino by sending a lawyer in to buy $3 million or something to that effect worth of chips. And just not spending the chips. There are...
Right. I think a lot of people are buying a lot of extra chips.
That's how this...
And whether or not Trump is actually soliciting it or actually wants it to happen, I think he does. But even if he doesn't, that's what's happening. Because, of course, why wouldn't people do that?
Yes.
It's cheap. If you can lobby the U.S. for $3 million of casino chips, you'll do
it. But yeah, this is the consequence of the... If the model that we're using is it's personality-driven, it's Trump is narcissist, it's a response to flattery, then the nations that are going to prosper and... If we're looking at policy, we would expect that we're going to see affinity for more corrupt countries because more corrupt countries are going to be more willing to engage in flattery and bribery. And in fact, we have seen one of the striking aspects of the Trump administration has been a rejection of these relationships with traditional allies who speak hard truths, like Merkel, especially, and also Macron. But yeah, we'll see. It's interesting. If that's the model. It'll be interesting sort of trying to flesh out, okay, from a prediction standpoint, from a forecasting standpoint, all right, now what's the policy implication of that? Like if given two options, which way do we think the United States is going to go? And it sounds like a lot of it is going to turn on assuming Trump is making a decision and this is his personality, how do we think it's going to affect the overall outcome?
I think part of it is also we have to look at what are the decisions where Trump is the guides the decision or is the ultimate decision maker, and which ones are essentially just, you know, keep plugging along because they're essentially bureaucratic institutions that make it quite
stable.
Like the
anti-corruption initiatives you're talking about. Trump probably didn't sit down with someone and say, I want to pursue anti-corruption initiatives in Romania. That's what the State Department's doing. And I think it's one thing to realize is that we have a large state that's continuing to do what it always does. And it's also an ineffective state because he hasn't appointed people to all these positions. So his influence is very powerful, but over a limited range of things where he can just issue fiats, you know, edicts, diktats of some kind. And I think that's where you'll see the erraticism. That's where you see the crazy changes of behavior.
But in diplomacy, we still, even if there's a lot of people missing at the top levels, so we still have ambassadors in a lot of places. We have, like where I live, we have a career appointed ambassadors, not a political appointee. And there's still the mid-level people. There's still the chief of mission. All these people are still existing. And if there is, you know, corruption going on here, something where they stand out, they can still make their statements. And simply just for the U.S. to say when something is going pretty awry domestically here, for the U.S. to stand up and say, no, this doesn't fly, has actually a lot of weight here. It has more weight than I think people realize in U.S. But it's not the sort of final decision. Domestic politics still have to run their course. But there is, they seriously do look to what the U.S. is doing, because essentially, to some degree, we guarantee their peace. And it has a role. And Trump will definitely not get involved in sort of the day-to-day operations of things like that. So, you know, that's the encouraging part. But then I look at it like, what happens when we're dealing with countries that have also a narcissistic leader? So when you're looking at something like North Korea, not that I don't think that anybody would have a great solution for North Korea, but clearly North Korea isn't going to pander to Trump.
I don't know how that
resolves, but it's interesting
because he seems to get along with the other narcissists.
How do you forecast that?
The people with the sort of natural authoritarian instincts. He relates to them. They have a lot to talk about. I don't know if Kim Jong-un, he certainly, the whole world revolves around him, but is he a narcissist exactly? I don't know the psychodynamics of him.
Yeah, this is strange. It's a good question, because the system is built on him being a god, essentially, but that doesn't mean that he thinks he is. So I don't know his own personal feelings.
Right. And he might be more effective if he knows that he's vulnerable in some way. Did you guys see the document dump, the leaks that The Onion got? Trump leaks?
Yes, I did. Yep. Worth checking out.
Good stuff.
Worth checking out.
Yeah, it's worth checking out. I particularly enjoyed the presidential daily briefs, which are basically things that you might get like for your kids to color on in Arby's.
Yeah, The Onion has done some good work lately.
You have to support journalism.
Yes, in all its forms. When you came back from your Ireland retreat, what's the one thing that you hadn't known that you saw over the last few weeks? That what was the most surprising thing or the most kind of attention-grabbing thing? Was it Covfefe?
I actually did know that. I for some reason, I was thinking I was looking at Twitter to see what people were saying about the Warriors game.
Was it like Roanoke? Was the island that you were at, did it have Covfefe carved in a tree?
I assume that's something the orb told him to say.
Yes.
That's the kind of thing that, like, on one hand, it's totally trivial. We vent a little steam by making fun of the Covfefe, however you pronounce it. You know, I mean, it was a ridiculous tweet. It's the kind of thing that, like, you know, your crazy uncle puts on Twitter or something.
But he's not president.
Yeah, exactly. It's trivial to you realize he's our president.
No, that's the problem. This erratic kind of mouthing off has real consequences when you're the president. Right. I see there's a – did you see the Covfefe Act that some Democrats are sponsoring?
Yeah, and it makes sense too.
Yeah, it's they want to demand that the Twitter records and social media accounts be preserved as presidential records.
Yeah.
And they are, because if he put something up there
– yeah.
He's speaking for the White House.
Similarly, there was a lawsuit. My law school has a First Amendment clinic, and they are part of a lawsuit to compel President Trump to unblock people. They're essentially saying that there's a First Amendment violation for the president.
So what is that? What is the First Amendment case against blocking someone?
It's a government restriction of speech. It would be the same as
was
if,
there How is it restricting speech? They can still speak.
No, well, so I think the argument is it's like a forum. It would be like if the president was in a square.
They just can't speak on his forum.
And people were talking to him, and he said, I don't like you and what you're saying. You need to leave. And you can magically make them. He could wish them into the cornfield. I haven't read the briefs. My understanding is that's a
interesting.
That's a general argument.
But he could give a speech to a room and not let everyone in.
Yes, but it's public. It's a public space.
So the question is, is Twitter and Facebook, are those public
spaces? But Twitter does allow you to keep people out of your section of it. It's not obvious to me it's open and shut. It's an interesting case.
We're not politicians. We are not public figures. And so as a public figure, does he have a different role?
Like I said, it's something I have a cursory understanding of. I haven't read it in more depth. But to me, I get the argument. We think of social media in one way, but when you are the president, I mean, and this has been the, some of the lawsuit, the executive order litigation, where the question is, when the president tweets something about policy, how serious is it? Is it policy? Is it not policy? If he says, this is a travel ban, we need to kick all the Muslims out. Is that something that you just say, well, it's just him on Twitter? Or do you say, no, this is
well, it's White interesting House because
and the White House has gone back and forth on it.
No, Spicer has said that it is, and then they say that it isn't. Right. The lawyers say that it is, and they say that it isn't. They say whatever suits them at the time. Yes. But the fact is, if the president says it, he's speaking for himself, and he is the key figure in the executive branch. There's no getting around that.
If this wasn't a case of Trump, if this was a case of somebody else, we've dealt with other forecasting issues on other countries where sometimes somebody who is not maybe the president, but somebody very highly placed or in a very high position will make a comment at, I remember one at World Economic Forum, or somebody makes a comment and then it's like, okay, is this actually policy because the equivalent of the Speaker of the House or whatever said it, or is this just a guy mouthing off, or is this a trial balloon? Because in some cases, governments will basically put out some information, see what how the general public responds, and then decide whether it's going to become official or not. And this was even sort of a question with recently with Mueller. So there's this idea that Trump was trying to get rid of Mueller, and his friend, supposedly a guy who really is his friend, and I don't remember his name, went on TV and was saying, Trump is considering getting rid of Mueller. And then later the White House was saying, basically, like, look at these terrible leaks. But the leak was actually his friend talking on TV. And then it went through the whole process of finally saying, no, Trump can't even do this. But is this just random? Are these random things happening? Or is there any sort of intent behind this to find out what the general public says? Can Trump, I don't think that Trump is actually doing this, but is he, basically, could he use Twitter as a tool to just spout off all sorts of things, see how they work? And if somebody says, if there's a big outcry against it, then no, that's just my social media. It's not really policy.
I don't know the answer to that question, but all of this discussion has made me really want to get Trump to block me.
Maybe
if I can just tweet to him, please block me, Mr. President.
I think
I just want to be blocked.
Yeah. He blocked Stephen King on Twitter, a frequent Trump critic. And then there was a report that
because of the whole it thing, the clear resemblances between the clown and
Pennywise and Trump. I believe that J.K. Rowling is still unblocked. And now the reports that she and Stephen King have been coordinating and she is tweeting stuff that Stephen King once tweeted. Something to that effect. They're working together at this point. I feel like this is your end. If you want to get banned.
This is the resistance.
This is the resistance. Just be part of this. Just say, hey, Stephen King says.
That's collusion.
And just keep doing it.
Well, the thing is, you don't actually need to follow Trump. I don't follow Trump, but I still see all of his tweets because they're just everywhere. Right. They've been beamed in your eyeballs.
Yes. We're getting there. We're getting there. But yeah, if you do that, that'd be great.
So does Stephen King then have to register as a lobbyist for a foreign power?
J.K. Rowling has more money than
J.K. Rowling is a foreign power. That is actually legit.
She represents the wizarding world.
Chuck Schumer's office. He's been doing some light trolling himself.
I learned, Chuck, if you're listening to this, I learned that Chuck Schumer lived in the dorm, the house where I lived in college. And we had when I was there, it actually closed when I was there because of a wild party we had. But it was an old hotel. The Gold Coast Hotel became the dorm that we lived in. And they had a pool with marble and water coming out of gargoyles and stained glass windows. And this was a clothing optional pool.
This is hashtag Harvard life.
Yeah, this is a sort of a famously libertine clothing optional pool. And apparently Chuck Schumer is somewhat famous for talking about the things he did at the clothing optional Adams House pool. So Chuck, if you're listening, we would love to have you on and talk about Adams House's pool.
I'm sure.
This is my bucket list.
That's the hook. All right. Anyway, so you, listener, can contact us, nonprofitspod pod@wordpress.com, pod@gmail.com. I think we can get an intern at some point. If we get the intern, soon you can you'll reach us on Twitter, Instagram, or whatever other bullshit social media platform is out there that I couldn't care less about. But yeah, if you have any questions or comments, let us know. Anything about the model, I think would be interesting as well. About models for understanding Trump. Because I see a lot of that. I know you guys see a lot of that as well. And sort of passively discussing Trump. It doesn't feel like people have coalesced around one way of looking at the presidency. And I think we will at some point. I think the personality-driven one is good. It has some explanatory power. All right, and we'll be back next week. It'll be interesting to see what happens in the intervening 7 days, presumably craziness. All right, guys. All right, talk to you soon.
Stay woke, guys.
Bye-bye.